This podcast is offered by Wildflowers and Sangha. A Dharma Talk by Roshi Amy to SLR, Hollowell.
Good evening, everyone. It's always a pleasure to enter the Zendo and see you all here. That's been a pleasure that I've had since I was a very young student, and I used to be my teacher's attendant and would come in. I would literally be the last one in the Zendo because I would be following her with the incense stick, and I loved walking in and seeing everyone there. And it was always a surprise in the sense of new. And just such a happy moment to know that we would share that time together, sitting together, like we did now. And like we do, like some of you do in the mornings. I am not present for various reasons, but I'm happy to know too that you're doing that, even if I don't enter the Zendo. So it's a rainy winter night here. Pretty ordinary January night in France, this part of France anyway, rain. I've been thinking this afternoon I took the metro. I had to go somewhere in the metro, and I rarely take the metro. I try to walk everywhere I go, or if I need to go a certain distance, then we go in the car, just to avoid contact. And when I came into the metro, I was on my way home. When I arrived onto the platform, the train was just sitting there, and there were lots of people on the platform, and the doors were open, and there were people inside of the train. And it was clear that the traffic was, as we say in the Paris metro, interrompu. So the traffic was interrupted on that line. And so I walked into the train and I looked around, kind of tried to get a feeling for what, you know, had this just happened, or had people been sitting there for a long time? And so as I advanced up the train, walking through the cabins, I asked a guy who was standing there and some people who were with him, how long have you been waiting here? And they were very angry, not with me, but with the fact that the train was stopped. And the guy said, well, now it's getting to be quite a long time. French, ça commence à faire très longtemps. Without telling me like how long. Was it 5 minutes? So I said to him, was it, you know, so what, it's like 15 minutes? And the woman who was sitting with him, he was standing and she was sitting, and she said, oh, but worse than that. We have no idea even, and we have no idea when it's starting again. Okay, so I just kind of walked on, and I realized I wasn't going to get some kind of information from them. So I just sat down and started reading my book, and occasionally there would be announcements, and I don't know how long actually I sat there. It was not 15 minutes, it was less, I think, but I was reading my book and it was okay. And I remembered when I came home, I I remember I had written something down that I had read earlier from a Zen teacher who recently died, who was the abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center in California, and who had been a student of Suzuki Roshi. And his name was Mel Weitzman. He died, like, I think he was 94 or something. And I had written down, he said, as long as there is no opposition, there is no problem. When you create opposition, then it becomes a problem. And this is really something to keep in mind and meditate on. Because, so if I put myself into that situation where I was today with the metro, I had no opposition to the fact that the train was stalled. Of course, I would have preferred that I could just hop on the train and it would go. But I was not creating this opposition within myself of wanting it to be other than what it is. And so it wasn't a problem. The people who I had stopped and talked to before and asked how long they had been there, they were in clear opposition to what the situation was. And they were very upset. I don't know what their circumstances were. You know, maybe they were late for an appointment. Maybe they had missed an appointment. Maybe they really had to go to the toilet. I don't know, you know, but there was clear opposition going on there. And therefore, there was a clear problem. And now we do this in our lives all the time, not only when the train isn't running like we want it to run, but we put up opposition to every moment almost, you know, wanting it to be something else, not wanting it to be what it is. And, you know, if we look at what our practice is about, what the point is, it's about being with things as they are. It's being here now, as we have said many times. And we have that great quote from Dogen, whose birthday it was this week, actually. Dogen, who is the founder of Zen in Japan, of our, as we practice it in Japan, in the 13th century. And his famous quote is, to study the way is to study the self. So to practice this way is to study self, or to practice the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. To be enlightened by the 10,000 things is to remove the barriers between oneself and others, or the barriers between oneself and the 10,000 things. Now there are different translations of the last line. I like this fairly modern, fairly clear one. And it also brings to mind this notion of not having opposition, not creating opposition, right? So not creating barriers. And the initial barrier that we create is self and other. You know, so he's saying, you know, to practice this way, to study this way, is to study that self. So look into it. What is it? Who am I? What is this that I'm constantly focused on and that I refer to and is my fixed point of interest and reference? And so when we study it, when we see through it, see into it, he says, that's to forget it. So forgetting it doesn't mean I don't exist. It just means that I don't, as this central, unique reference point, I'm no longer that. It means to no longer see only yourself. Which brings us to the next one. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. And the language that is used in these phrases is you can't really understand it and the way that it's phrased. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. So when you are enlightened by the 10,000 things, you forget the self. But when you forget the self, you are enlightened by the 10,000 things. So it works both ways. Okay. The 10,000 things, what is that? This is a great koan. This is Zhuang's Dharma name. So that's his like life koan, right? The 10,000 things, 10,000 is a number that is used to mean a lot or infinite or everything, something like that. Everything, you know, can seem too sommaire, I would say in French, can seem too I don't know how I would translate, kind of like limiting, you know, I say everything, it's just this one category or something. Basic. Someone said something? Lisa?
Basic?
Yeah, maybe it's too too basic. It doesn't allow us to open up, include all the infinite variety of things. Maybe if we said everything's, you know, or all things, plural, you know, so we get all the diversity. So it's not just the unity of everything. And so then when we get the 10,000 things, that opens it to like a big number, which is not limited to 10,000, okay? And then to be enlightened by the 10,000 things is to remove the barriers between oneself and others. So it's basically telling us that to study the self is to see that that's concept is a barrier, and if we lift that barrier, if we see through it and we no longer hold to that barrier, then we're enlightened by the 10,000 things. Now, what does it mean to be enlightened, right? This is the tricky thing. We have a lot of ideas about this. This past weekend, I led a workshop for another group, for Shambhala, which is another Buddhist school, Tibetan, that comes from Trungpa Rinpoche, if you've heard of him. And they invited me to lead a workshop online. It was supposed to be in person, but of course it wasn't. And during that workshop, someone's at the end of the workshop, actually, in the last final sharing circle time, a woman said, well, you know, if we were enlightened, we wouldn't be doing this weekend. And because the workshop was focusing on activity that wasn't enlightened, you know, that was harmful, because it's a Buddhist group that has a lot of is in turmoil at the moment, and they have a lot of problems with power abuse and all kinds of violations of limits and ethics and things. And so, and then, but I said to her, or I said to them all, I said, you know, Dogen said, because we are enlightened, we're doing this. We're not doing this to become enlightened. It's because we are enlightened, we are doing this. And I added, and this is quoting Suzuki, more or less, in fact, there are no enlightened beings. There is only enlightened activity, enlightened actions, right? So what do we mean by enlightened activity? What's the word that Joa, you like to use? Not wholesome, but what is it? Maybe wholesome.
Wholesome. I like using wholesome.
Wholesome, Sana. Yeah. What?
Yeah. It's sama in Pali, right. So it's wholesome.
Yeah. Wholesome. Or we could say something like that goes towards life, that sees the oneness, you know, that cultivates cultivates basic goodness, cultivates wholeness, rather than opposition, aggression, strife, separation. And so we could say that's enlightened activity, because enlightenment in this way that we're using it just means not being in opposition. So being one with, seeing the oneness, the unity. And so if I go back to Mel Weitzman's thing of, as long as there is no opposition, there's no problem. When we're not building opposition, that's enlightened activity, we could say. But that's moment to moment. Every single moment is, what kind of activity are we cultivating in every moment? And that's why what Dogen says is, because we're enlightened, we're doing this, in the sense that the very act of, he was talking about sitting meditation, Zazen, that very act is an acknowledgement that that act is an act of oneness. Unity is present in that. That's a moment of living, manifesting non-separation, emptiness, wholeness, whatever you want to call it. So in Dogen's quote, when he says, to be enlightened by the 10,000 things is, there's no longer separation between myself and the 10,000 things. It's all one. I'm fully present to whatever arises, to each of the 10,000 things that arises. It's a way of, in our vows, when we chant, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. I mean, I think I would prefer to see them, but for the moment we say save them. It doesn't mean this impossible task of they're numberless and I'm going to save them all. It means that each one is worthy. Each one is to be seen. The 10,000 things, each one is a moment, can be experienced as a moment of awakening, of enlightenment, let's say. If we come to it without opposition. Often we come with opposition, because we don't like it, or we don't want it, or we're our mind is clouded with all kinds of other thoughts of wanting to be somewhere else, or projections about the person, or the people on the metro, they didn't want it to be that way. They were expecting it to be a certain way, and it wasn't happening like that, and so that caused problems. It means simply being where you are without trying to escape. Because there is no escape, actually. Like I say, that's the good news and that's the bad news. If there was some kind of escape, then there would be somewhere else that you need to be or could be, but you can't be anywhere else. This is where you are. This is who you are. This is the moment. And to put up opposition to that then creates suffering, pain. Struggle, aggression. So when we chant at night or at the end of our sittings, time swiftly passes by, awaken. It means just to be where you are without trying to escape, something like that. And that's what our practice is about. Actually, that's why we sit here on our cushions.
That doesn't sound difficult.
It doesn't, does it? It doesn't, but it is. Yes. It sounds very simple, but it's difficult. It doesn't sound difficult at all. Because, what my husband said to me today, something like, we have trouble because we make simple things complicated. Something like things are difficult because we make simple things complicated, or something like that. And I said, I forget what it was, something about making simple things complicated and in any case, yes, it sounds simple, but it's not. And why isn't it? So Christine, if you say that it's not, what's difficult about it in your experience?
Good question. It has already become a bit simpler. I realize that I'm having less resistance towards things when I compare to what I've been like before doing this practice. But the really without this practice, I had no idea of this concept or this kind of seeing things, and then it just seems normal to be in opposition to at least what you don't like.
Yeah, that's what's most familiar, actually. That's true. Debbie?
For for a while, I applied this being in opposition systematically to French people. And I asked some French people that I knew and trusted why exactly every time I said something, everybody said, no, that's not it. And apparently you learn it in school. In cinquième, I didn't go to school here, but that's what the person answered. In cinquième, you learn to advance the conversation through opposition, through argumentation. So that's how you get to know something, is by saying, no, what you're saying is not true. This is what the truth is. And then the other person says no, and then now we have a conversation.
Interesting, huh? Yeah. Yeah, it's very embedded in our cultures, you know, not only in France, but in our, you know, if we look into our beings, the notion of, you know, wanting to be right or have a position, you're weak if you don't have a position or if you don't take a position or something. And to build up this sense of self, sense of who I am, this identity, that's very powerful. Dogen is asking us to take the opposite, to do the opposite, to forget that, and by doing that, then to see the beauty of the 10,000 things, and the 10,000 points of view, and the 10,000 positions, and the 10,000 people who hold them. But it's not easy to let go of that, to forget that self. And it's not forget in the sense of I'm not acknowledging it, I'm denying it. It's not that. João?
Because many times opinion or position, like we were using, is a trap. Many times that's what it becomes. It becomes a trap it's a trap for myself. A trap in the sense of, you know, getting stuck, being stuck in one single way of seeing or understanding or hearing. It limits the opinion or the position. You can see, and it's not to say that, well, we shouldn't have opinions or positions or make a certain stand about something, about any subject. You can still do it, but if you look at it from, it may look the same, but if you, depending where you arrive at that point, it's different. And it may even look the same, and I may even do the same thing or say the same words, but depending on where I'm coming from, it's different.
And what is that? What are the different places you would be coming from? How would you explain that?
Awareness has something to do with it, but I'm not very happy with that answer.
Could you say that if you come from a place of attachment to self, then you will be
definitely
hanging on to the opinions and limiting your view of the world, whereas if you come from a place of non-separation, of not attachment to self, then you would have...
The thing is that sometimes I'm not even aware, I may not even be aware that I'm attached to an image of, you know. That's the trick. Many times that's the trick a bit. To see that.
Exactly. And that's where practice comes in.
Yeah.
We become more and more aware of when we're doing that. That's where awareness is important, as you say. Now, can we discriminate on the basis of non-discrimination? You know, discriminating in the sense of seeing the differences, clearly recognizing that there's different positions and different opinions, but doing that on the basis of non-discrimination, meaning not judging, something like that, you know, maybe. Yeah. But it does. It takes a deep awareness of what is, who am I? What is self? That's why Dogen says that's what his practice is about, to study the self. Christine has her hand up again.
Yeah, I just thought, does it maybe have something to do with that we kind of have the illusion that if we are in a position to things we don't like people in the metro, that the fact that we are in a position makes things move faster, you know, that they are not at peace with the metro standing, and kind of some illusion makes us believe that if we're not at peace, then it will go faster, you know, move. I think maybe that's one of the, something that's going on when we get in such resistance. Because I also still do that from in certain situations, or, you know, it's easy to, I think it's maybe something like that, that we think our not being at peace with the situation makes the situation change more quickly.
Yeah, that if we don't have some opposition, if we don't hang on to that, well, it's almost like, well, we're giving up.
Yeah, and why then should it change? Why should the metro...
That we can somehow control it.
Yeah.
Come to that,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, that's maybe 1.2. So
that all, whatever it is that we're doing, will make it change. And in fact, things that are as they are, whether we like them or not, you know. So, yeah. Anna. You need to turn on your microphone. Yeah.
Okay. It sounds to me that what Debbie and João said, it sounds to me that it is the same. Because it's a question of trying to participate, trying to be part of what's going on. And this is something that we learn in school. Participate, take part, don't be aside. Develop this. And it sounds to me that it's the same thing, that the boss brought here. How can we bring something without taking a position? How can we participate in a, how do we say that, debate, how do we say that? How can we participate in, how do we say debate, João?
Debate?
Debate, yes. How can we participate in a debate if we don't take our own position, our own way of seeing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure what we mean by debate. And there's nothing wrong with a position in the sense of, you know, right or wrong. What the problem is when we cling to the position and when we become identified with the position, and then there's no room for any other position, that it's the one unique position that, and everyone else is wrong. You know, we have the right position and the others have the wrong position. And like what João was saying, you know, he even used this kind of image of it limits us when we hold on to that position. Now, immediately, you know, I can see what's happening when we have these kinds of discussions. The mind of separation and duality takes over and sees then, okay, well, if I can't hang on to my position, then I don't have a position. And kind of what Christine was saying, you know, then it's in French, we would say c'est foutu. You know, it's like, it's over, you know, we're nobody. The argument, there's no point in arguing that, you know, then everything is going to hell in a handbasket, as we say in English. And that's the dualistic mind that thinks that way. That it's either this or it's that. And so that's why I suggested that option of taking positions, you know, seeing positions from a place of a position of non-position, maybe something like that, non-discrimination, from a place of unity. So seeing the difference from a place of unity. And so that could mean, yes, you do, you know, you stand up for what you think is appropriate. And you speak that, you express that, however you want to do it. And you respect the other's possibility to do that too. And you respect their positions, even if they aren't the same as yours. And welcome them from a position of wholeness, from including the different positions, rather than having some positions okay and pushing the others away. Something like that. You know, the position we would be talking about here is the position that is no position and that includes all positions. Something like that. It's all hypothetical, what I'm saying. You know, this is all conceptual. And I wish that we had, you know, real examples that we could say, you know, like you had these elections in Portugal on Sunday. So people took positions. And you had this guy from the extreme right who you know, got a lot of votes, right? You can agree with his position or not, but it's his right to express, it's the people's right to, I mean, in the sense of a democracy, you have the right to express your views, but then we can say from a position, if we're discriminating, we can say, well, his views don't go in a wholesome way. You know, he's discriminating against people. He's, I don't know exactly what he says, but I've heard that, you know, he's against immigrants, he's against the Roms, the gypsies, he's, I don't know exactly what it is, but this is going against a place of wholeness. So we can judge it from that position without saying I'm right and he's wrong. I don't know if you follow what I'm saying. I'm trying to give an example of Filipa, yeah.
When you first, Demiroshi, when you first started to talk, I immediately remembered of something that happened to me yesterday. And now that you were saying the others are right and I'm wrong or whatever, and I was thinking, what if I'm right and I'm wrong? I mean, this happened to me yesterday. I decided to do something which was clearly opposition. So it was very hard and I was fighting the whole day, but something in my mind also was present and said, maybe you should wait for a day and it will solve itself and it will be easier tomorrow. But I didn't, I did take the control. So I knew I was doing something which was right or wrong or something. So I was right and I was wrong at the same time. This is how I'm seeing it now. It's interesting. So it's hard to know, very hard to know what to do sometimes.
So did that help you though to open to the space of both?
To now, but I already suffered yesterday the pains of fighting it, and it wasn't necessary probably. So it's good to see. It's clear now. What happened? I think.
Yeah. And that's the kind of experience that I'm talking about. Is, you know, so moment to moment in your daily life when these things come up, you know, like I give the example of the metro. So it's, am I putting up an opposition? Am I setting up dualities in this moment? And that's, and without knowing what the outcome will be, like Filipa said, Mathieu Ricard, I read recently something where he said, it was in French, so it was, it doesn't matter if the road is long. There's no point in trying to fix an expiration date or a deadline. The essential thing is to know that the road is going in the right direction. So we don't know where that road is taking us, but if we keep this compass of wholeness, oneness, basic goodness, compassion, and wisdom as our guide, then the road is going in the right direction. We don't know how long the road will be. We don't know how many turns it will take. You know, we have this cone of the 99 turns. We don't know who we will meet on that road, but we stick to that compass of that direction. Going in the right direction. But it's not easy. It's not easy. And yet, if we just think of it in terms of just sitting on your cushion, breathing, and then standing up and breathing in moment to moment, without, you know, throwing objectives like Matthieu Ricard says of like deadline and how long it is, and I'll never get there, and you will never get there, but you're already here, so you're already there, so you will never get there because you're already there. If you can see that, well, then you're enlightened by the 10,000 things. Joa?
Yeah, the word that comes to mind for me when we're talking about opposition and the various situations that we might find ourselves in is the term cost. What are the costs that we are actually paying? Because sometimes I feel knowing what is wholesome might be a little bit difficult to see, but what I find very recently, what I've been paying attention to is trying to feel how it feels in the body when we encounter a situation that is not pleasant, or where we feel we are in a position, or we feel we're struggling, and trying to focus on how does it feel in the body? How does it appear? And where is it going to lead me? And do I want to cultivate this? I found that very useful. And this whole discussion also reminded me that I really like the fact that in the early texts, they talk about entering the stream. We're entering the stream. But it's always a little bit confusing because it feels like we're entering a path, but at the same time, the path that we're entering seems to go to follow a current that is very contrary to our impulses. And at the same time, by opening up to what the reality is, we really follow the current at the same time. We really follow the flow of life. So it kind of goes, the current goes in many directions, can be seen in various directions. So yeah, I really like paying attention to what the how it feels in the body, and how when we are in the various situations that were mentioned, those like when if we can just stop and it's like, okay, how does it feel to take a stand like this, or to listen to a stand, or to feel the aggression, or to how is that located, and how does it feel? Yeah, I found that very useful question.
Because it is physical, you know. We do feel that opposition in the body. Tension, resistance, stress, those are all indications of that opposition, you know. And it can be even more subtle. I think Joe is also saying, you know, it can even be more subtle than that. And what kind of emotions is it bringing up? And, you know, at this moment in our, this time in the world, we all are confronted with a very basic situation of holding on to our positions or not, our desires or not, and putting up oppositions or not. if we go in the direction of wholeness and what is good, let's say, and what is not only about me, we wear a mask. We respect the distances, social distancing. If there are rules, you know, I think some of you in Portugal and in the UK, you have, you know, you're in lockdown. Here in France, we're not yet, but after 6 o'clock, we're not supposed to be outside. All of those are, so we don't put up an opposition to those. We may not like it. We may have an opinion about it. We may think that it should be done differently. And yet we know that, okay, we accept to let go of our position or our opposition and just do it. The practice, this practice is about just do it. Like my teacher said to me, Amy, just do it. We enter the stream, as Joa said. And a lot of the time when we're entering the stream and we're in the stream, we're like struggling because it's, you know, the posture of sitting is painful. We have to sit until the 40-minute bell rings, or we have to eat in a certain way. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of these rituals now online, but those are all, we use those all to help us to go towards wholeness and fullness and experience oneness, rather than resisting the stream, resisting the current, resisting, imposing our, you know, if we don't wear a mask and we're sick, well then we're going to cause harm. And so we do what we need to do to, you know, ease the pain, limit the suffering and the harm. That's a really concrete one we can all look at. As we were looking for concrete examples, that's one you can look at. And sometimes you don't like it and you're fed up with the rules and you're fed up with staying home. And you, it's ruining your life and it's making things complicated and you lose your job or, you know, whatever it is. And yet you do it. Something bigger than you. It's about something bigger than you. That is also you. But it's bigger than the you that you think you are. We're almost out of time. I want to remind you that we have a day of practice on Sunday. If you haven't signed up, send an email to Wildflower France and you will receive a link at some point. I think Lisa was planning to send it today or tomorrow. And so you will have the link so you can connect and the schedule. I think you should already have. It was in an email at some point. If you didn't receive that, then write too, and it'd be great to have you with us. I also would like to announce that on these Thursday nights, starting in February, there will always be a talk, but with my Dharma brother and sister, Corinne and Frank, we've decided to be kind of creative, and so we will be inviting each other to give talks, and then so if Frank is invited on a Thursday night to give a talk, then his Sangha can also join in. And when he invites me to give a talk in his Sangha, my Sangha will receive the link and can join in. And same with Corinne, and we will probably invite other people too. Joa will also be giving talks sometimes, so it won't always be me every Thursday night. I still will, of course, give talks, but we're trying to, you know, liven this up a little bit. And because we have this possibility, we decided, well, let's be creative with it and do interesting things and bring the sanghas together. Already there's someone from Corinne's sangha who sits with us on Fridays, I hear, and on Friday mornings. So it's a one dharma, one sangha.
And this is very wonderful. Thank you, Ruchi.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm glad you like it. Yeah, I think it will be rich for everybody to get a taste for the way that they, their flavors and the way how they talk and what they talk about and their students and to meet others. You know, already it's been great that all of us from in all these different countries have been able to come together. On Thursday nights, we never had as many people. And, you know, I see the people in Paris, I would see once or twice a week all the time, but the rest of you who aren't in Paris, and even some who are in Paris, you know, Christine, I don't see that often. But even some who are in Paris, we didn't see each other as often as we have in the past year. Which is fantastic. Even if it's not the same thing as being in the same room, still, we're in the same Zendo here. And it's a pleasure. Debbie?
Can we invite our friends to this that are not necessarily part of any of the sanghas? I have a very shy friend who wanted me to make sure that she was welcome.
Absolutely. Everyone's welcome, yeah. Everyone's welcome.
I'd also like to add that there have been some questions about the financial aspects and the giving and the money and all that. So we are still in the process of discussing it. We have a meeting tomorrow night, an assembly, and we'll be discussing that. So we are aware that we need to clarify that point, and it will be clarified very soon. Hopefully.
Yeah, the financial aspects have never really been our strong point. My strong point, of course, and so if it's not mine, then it's no one else's. Although I try to listen to everyone. So that's part of the problem. It's also it was complicated by the past year when everything changed. We closed our center. Within 6 months, we were in confinement. We couldn't meet. So everything has changed. So that's part of why there's been some delay. But we hope to resolve it tomorrow night and have clarity. So thank you for your patience. Okay.
So we will recite the vows. So thank you.